Thank you very much indeed, and it's a great pleasure for me to be here, particularly at this moment in our political history. Every once in a while, economics has a way of turning into an interesting subject. And the vote that was taken a few days ago in the United Kingdom, what is still for the moment the United Kingdom, highlights for us, I think, especially the relevance of the question of economic inequality. This is something which emerges very clearly if you look at a map, and there have been maps in the British press in the last several days, of the distribution of the vote to leave or remain in the European Union. The distinction between the areas that voted to remain and those that voted to leave could not be more clear in geographic terms. The center of London, stalwartly choosing to remain, the Midlands, the Northeast, and so forth, all choosing to leave. The distinction between the financial centers and the less successful and industrial peripheries is just very graphically revealed in that very simple way. And that has given rise to interpretations of this event, which treat it as an instance of differential reaction to success, greater or less success, success or failure, failure may be too strong a term, of the regions of the UK to the process of integration with Europe, and more broadly speaking, to the process of globalization. And it has given rise also in recent days to a considerable fear, anxiety, that the same differentiation, the same structure of inequalities may produce similar fissures in other countries of the European Union, notably in France, in Holland, in Italy, and elsewhere. And beyond that, there is the ongoing broader question of the relationship between inequality and globalization in the wider world, including in the United States and in the Asian and Pacific region. So this is an instance in which matters that have been of academic interest for some time have suddenly found themselves very much in the center of the world stage. Now, of course, the interest in inequality as a topic of academic research in the modern era is not new. It goes back perhaps to the early 1990s. Just to the point when it became clear to the broad mainstream of the economics profession that the post-war order of stable distribution and the underlying assumptions of a constant returns to scale Cobb-Douglas production function with marginal productivity pricing were not holding in the modern world, and that for this reason inequality was rising, something had to be explained. And when the economics profession set out to do that, they fashioned, by and large, it fashioned a set of explanations and even a debate over the range of possible explanations which fit squarely within the previously existing intellectual framework. In the advanced countries, and particularly in the United States, if you go back to the landmark article of Bound and Johnson in the American Economic Review in 1993, you find the setting out of the hypothesis of a skill bias in technological change as the underlying force. And this is rooted in the very familiar structures of supply and demand in the labor market, and gave rise over a period of time to the theses of Golden and Katz of a race between education and technology as the driving force. Against which there was, at least for a while, although it faded out, I think, by the end of the 1990s, a view that the phenomenon could be better explained not by shifts in the relative demand for labor, but by shifts in the effective relative supply brought on either by immigration or more broadly by the expansion of trade and therefore the competition of low-wage workers from the industrializing world, from the developing world, with the established working classes of the developed countries. Thesis that was argued very effectively in 1994 by Adrian Wood, or at least with great intellectual clarity. In the development economics literature, there was another tradition, and that tradition was drawn essentially and built upon the work going back to the 1950s and before of Simon Kuznets, the economic history of industrial transitions, and it evolved into a discussion of the relationship between inequality and the rate of growth. These two trends were never fully and still are not fully integrated in the literature. They continue to exist. And it is an interesting fact that they continue to define for the economics profession largely how the question of rising inequality can be addressed in the professional literature. If you look at the classification codes of the Journal of Economic Literature to this day, codes that we all take as a guide to the structure of our subject, what you find is that the question of inequality is to be examined either in this context of the microeconomics of labor markets or perhaps under the rubric of development. The particular area that I plan to talk about this morning, therefore, essentially from the standpoint of the taxonomy of our profession, does not exist. Which, of course, makes it a particularly interesting area to explore. I got into this question some 20 years ago, thanks to the incentives offered by a foundation, now the Century Foundation, then the 20th Century Fund, which asked me to assess the two lines of argument that I just described for the developed countries, the two lines of labor market literature as they existed at that time. And it became clear to me that I could not contribute effectively to that discussion unless I was able to draw a more clear and thorough picture of what was actually happening initially in the United States and later on in the world. And the question then became one of whether it would be possible to develop a factual foundation which was richer, denser, more consistent for comparative and historical purposes than was available in the literature to that time. I will give you the credo that I found that I've used quite a bit to describe this work. It comes from the writings of the American philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, that Kepler undertook to draw a curve through the places of Mars, and his greatest service to science was in impressing on men's minds that this was the thing to be done if they wished to improve astronomy, that they were not to content themselves with inquiring whether one system of epicycles was better than another, but that they were to sit down to the figures and find out what the curve in truth was. That seemed to me to be a highly relevant task, although a very mundane one, and in the structure of our profession, a low prestige activity. It was also a question of what method could you use, given that the study of inequality was based and is still largely based upon the historical record of surveys of individuals, mostly of households of different kinds, surveys of consumption, surveys of income gross of tax, net of tax, and so forth. That record exists. It's been compiled heroically by initially staff members of the World Bank, later on by the World Institute for the World Institute for Development Economics Research in Helsinki, and others. And that's a very, very valuable record. But it is a record with important limitations. There are major gaps for countries through time. There are major gaps in the coverage of countries. There are major inconsistencies, or at least non-comparabilities, between the types of surveys that have been conducted. And it is therefore very hard to use that record to make a consistent comparative analysis. Is it possible to improve upon or to replace surveys that were missing or that are not consistent for periods in the past? The answer is no, of course. You can only survey people in the present. You can't go back and find the households of 1980 and ask them what their incomes were at that particular time. Those records and memories, in fact, the household themselves, largely no longer exist. So one is stuck if that is the framework of information for your analysis with a partial and limited record. What we thought, though, and what we discovered was that it is quite easy to mine a vast body of readily and inexpensively available administrative data and to derive from that data very simple measures of inequality across group structures. One does not need the underlying micro records. The aggregated published tables are perfectly adequate so long as one has a geographic division or an industrial or a sectoral division for an economy into a sufficient number of groups. Usually in the case of sectors, around 30 is perfectly adequate. And so long as one has two bits of information on each group, namely its total employment or population and its total income or payroll, one can compute the inequality between the groups. That is what is called in the shaded box, the between groups component of Tiles' T statistic, an element of the family of generalized entropy measures of inequality. If you had the micro data, you can build up the underlying inequality within groups and then add that up using a weighted income weighting to get an overall inequality within groups and add the between groups component. But the reality is that with the kind of data that we're working with, we only have this between groups component, and that is for each group, one can compute its weight in the population and its income, average income relative to the average income of the population as a whole. When you have those two things, and the log of the second term, you multiply them together and you add them up and you have the between groups component of Tiles' T statistic. If a group has zero population, it adds nothing to inequality. If it has an average income equal to the global average, it adds nothing to inequality. Otherwise, it lies either above or below the average. If it's above the average, the term is positive. If it's below, it's negative because of the log term. Is there some water, by chance? It would be nice. Okay. Here's an example of inequality measured in the United States, 69 through 2009, between counties using the local area personal income statistics from the United States Department of Commerce. Basically, tax data using the total income of each of and population of each of the 3,150 county-level units in the United States. It's a measure which tracks very closely the known and reasonably reliable current population survey or Census Bureau measures of personal income inequality in the United States. And it shows you very clearly, by the way, where the peaks are in 2000 and around 2007. And you can, with this kind of a measure, you can go further and actually map out the distribution of income across counties, across the counties of the United States, and their relative importance to the overall measure of inequality. The peak on the skyscraper in the Northeast is obviously the county of New York, New York, that is to say Manhattan, which is to say Wall Street. In the far West, one can see the effect of Silicon Valley, but also there pop up here and there, this is the late 2000s, some of the highly speculative centers of real estate and mortgage finance operations that existed just prior to the great bust in 2007, 2008. So it's a method which permits one not only to see the overall picture in a way which imitates reasonably well a high quality survey instrument, but also to break it out into the underlying geographic components and to see how each of them, or sectoral components, and see how each of them contributes to the overall inequality and to see how those contributions evolve over time. In the run-up to 2001, to the internet and information technology bust, the major contributions came from just five counties. New York, three counties in Northern California, Santa Clara, San Mateo, and San Francisco, and King County, Washington, which is Seattle, which is Microsoft. And you can see this in the data. It gives you a very fine and clear analysis. And it can be done for many countries for which the kind of careful and systematic long-term survey data are simply not available. We need it in order to develop an international comparison that would work successfully to gain access to a systematic international database. And we found one quite a long time ago now in the industrial statistics of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, which we were able to turn into a very large data set of these tile statistics between groups, components of tiles, T statistic across countries. So much so that by now, with the data set being updated to about 2011, we have over 4,000 observations from about 150 countries in the data set. And this provides us with quite a systematic body of evidence about the movement of inequality in the world, at least inequality in industrial pay. The question of whether that inequality is related to incomes is one which I will come to presently. But what I want to do now is to show you how this data evolve, these data evolve over time in a series of maps where the color scale reflects the changes over a six-year interval. And the scale here is one in which light to dark blue represent decreases in inequality, yellow to orange to red represent increasing inequality. And this first one comes from a period 1963 to 1968 when there's a mixed picture in the world, but the prevailing one is of modestly decreasing inequality in these particular measures of the structure of industrial pay. As you move, however, into the 1970s, and in particular the period of the oil shock and the global recession, you see a pattern that changes quite dramatically. And as you move into the 1980s and the global debt crisis, you see, again, a dramatic shift toward increasing inequality with very strong regional components or elements to it. That is to say, you look at South America in the early and mid-1980s, and you can find very rapidly rising inequality measures across the entire region. It's not specific to individual countries. It would appear to affect a phenomenon or to reflect a phenomenon that is influencing the region and indeed the world economy as a whole. And I would argue that the most plausible candidate for that is the global debt crisis that set in around 1980. If you move into the 1990s, you will not be surprised to discover that the major change in inequality is now in the regions affected by the collapse of the Soviet Union and its East European dependencies, and of course also in China. So one has, again, a pattern of rising inequality, which is general around the world, but with a very specific regional focal points at any given time. And as you go on into the 2000s, this pattern reaches a peak, and actually, notwithstanding recent literature, which has argued that there is always a tendency for inequality to increase, actually in the period up to the most recent data for which we've been able to compile these maps, we can see that there has actually been some stabilization and modest declines, admittedly from high levels by historical standards, but still a pattern which is quite different from the pattern of 1980 through the 2000s. This is just a way of compressing a very large amount of national data into a relatively simple and, I hope, clear-cut representation of what seems to have been going on in the world. But it raises a question of whether, from the standpoint of economic analysis, there is a systematic relationship between these measures of inequality and, let's say, other unified and substantial economic phenomena. And I would argue for you that there is such a relationship, and it is one which has been documented in a paper based on work developed by a student of mine, actually, just in the past year, who set out to take our measures of industrial pay inequality and to ask if they're associated to movements of the exchange rate, and to do this country by country by country in a very systematic way for a large number of cases. Here's a set of, about a dozen scatter plots of the inequality measure and the exchange rate for a set of countries. And in 10 of the 12 cases, the exceptions being the Russian Federation and South Africa, you can see a very clear-cut upward sloping relationship. Which is to say that depreciations in national currency values with respect to the dollar tend to produce, pretty systematically, increases in the measure of inequality across industrial sectors in these countries. And the question would then be, why would that be the case? And I would suggest that when you think about it, it really is very simple why that might be the case. In any country, you have two types of industrial activities, those that sell to the outside world and those that don't. And should the exchange rate depreciate, the incomes that flow in national currency units to those who are selling to the outside world go up, whereas the incomes of those selling in the internal market do not, at least not initially. And as a result, since export industries tend to have higher pay than non-export industries just about everywhere, an inequality measure will rise, not as a behavioral response, but as an accounting matter, and not with a lag, but the very next morning. And that pay will go somewhere in the sector. It'll be reflected mainly just to, it might be just to the top executives, which would exacerbate the phenomenon. But it will bring an increase in the inequality measure across countries, and that will be reflected in a correlation between the inequality measure and the exchange rate. Very clear-cut evidence that at least this aspect of inequality can be accounted for by a financial, global, macroeconomic phenomenon for which one does not need an explanation based on skills or technology or education or even trade volumes, but rather simply on the relative price in the terms of trade, if you like, in the internal and external markets. I can show you how these things play out through time. Here's Australia. The bar is the The inequality measure, and the line is the exchange rate. Here is Singapore, here is Canada, very nice example. Country that trades with the United States has either internal or US selling industries, very clear cut. This is Mexico, also a very clear cut case. Hungary, it's really hard to beat these as a set of bivariate correlations. Romania, India, and one could go on. Okay. The question then is, while this is, I think, by itself an interesting phenomenon and one which has distinct relevance for some of the questions that are of greatest interest to economists, such as the effect of technology and skill demand on in the labor market, most of the work on inequality in the literature is work based upon household incomes. That is because surveys are generally focused on households, and because the economists who are concerned about social welfare are generally concerned about the distribution across households. So the question that we then asked was, is there a systematic and close relationship between the measures that we have made of inequality across industries drawn from this one data set and other measures of household income inequality? And that could be answered by a regression analysis, which was essentially a regression of our measures against a reference group of overlapping country year observations in the case that we set out with initially and are still using. It's the Dininger and Squire data set that was initially published in 1996, with controls for whether we are talking about income or expenditure, households or individuals, gross or net of tax. The coefficient LN final in the shaded box is the regression coefficient of our tile measure on the overall on the reference Gini coefficient, and you can see that there is in fact a very close and tight relationship. The variable just below, which is also significant and important, is the relation is the share of manufacturing employment in total population, a measure of the degree of industrialization of a country. More industrialized countries almost invariably have a lower measure of overall inequality than less industrialized countries. But control for that, control for the type of measure that's in the reference data set, and you can see that there is a very strong and stable relationship between the inequality measure that we developed and the one which has been the ones that have been basically at the heart of the international comparative literature. That's reassuring, not surprising, but it's significant because it then suggests that if there is a causal relationship, it surely runs from the exchange rate phenomena that I just described to the manufacturing inequality measure that I've just described, and from there to the inequality in household incomes, that the last phenomenon is being driven substantially by the first two. Not entirely, but to a very substantial degree. And it was then possible, using just the two coefficients that I've just described, to use those regression estimates to generate a large, consistent data set of estimated household income inequality on a gross household income basis. That is to say, after transfers, before taxes, which we did. And I think I gave you in this previous slide, now it's there. The result over the period up to 2008 is 3,871 estimates for 149 countries. Again, a very dense and consistent panel estimate. And the question that has to be asked then is, are the measures any good? That forces one into the business of making comparisons of our measures with the measures in the literature, which is to say everybody else's. And that is a task that requires a great deal of persistence, which I am happy to say is a defining characteristic of the very talented students that I've been working with, in particular this young lady, Beatrice Halbach, who set about copying from every article she could find the inequality measures that were being published and used and the descriptions of them, and then classifying those descriptions broadly into three categories. Green at the top is market income, red at the bottom is disposable income, blue in the middle is gross income, the black line is our measure, the dotted lines are the market and disposable income estimates, inequality estimates used in the standardized world income inequality data set, the SWIID by Frederick Salt. And this is Canada, and you can see that there is, even across such a relatively small, relatively well-organized, certainly data-sophisticated country, a very wide dispersion in inequality measures depending upon what concept you're using. And you can see that very nicely in this case, our measure falls squarely in the middle of the gross income inequality measures. And so I would declare, and also has the same general trend, that the model that we're using to generate our measures works pretty well in this case, right? About as well as you might expect. This is Denmark, even smaller and more equally or better organized country, still a wide dispersion of measures. Again, ours falls pretty squarely in the middle. France, the data are not nearly so good, but there you can see where our measures are. This is Germany, and we have here two measures for the period up to 1989. You can see the declining series is our estimate for the late German Democratic Republic, after that, unified Germany, where we are, in fact, spot on the, so far as I can tell, one existing survey of gross income inequality. This is Greece, obviously much more chaotic scene. Italy, Japan, the Netherlands, Spain, Sweden, the United Kingdom. Again, our measures seem to, our little model seems to track the measure that we're interested in pretty well. For the United States, the story is a little different. And you can see that although we tracked the measure up to the late 1990s pretty well, maybe early 1990s, we drift below it in the late 1990s. And the reason for that, I think, is pretty clear. You can see from the peaks in the blue series for gross income there is a large element in household income data for the United States, which is capital income, which is closely associated with the movement of capital asset prices of the stock market. And since our model is based on industrial pay, it's not going to pick that up. And it doesn't. So one has to allow for the fact that the measure is not perfect, but this is an instance where it's pretty clear why the divergence between our measures and the, let's say, the Congressional Budget Office's measures exist. If one goes to the transition economies, there's a very interesting, I think, systematic difference between what one finds for them and what one finds for the, what might call the advanced Western countries. Coming back to the United States, and you could see this all the way through the series I've been showing you, market income inequality is vastly higher than it is for disposable income inequality. True systematically, even in highly social democratic countries such as Denmark or Holland. Now, why is that? One possible interpretation that the markets are very unequal and that the society does an excellent job of redistributing income, but that would be to assign a prior character to the households that exist in social democratic countries. And the reality is that in such countries, there are many households which have zero market income, because they are able to exist on pensions and other sources, state pensions and other sources of non-market income. And those family types of households, generally speaking, don't exist in the transition economies or in the developing world. And what one finds there is that the so-called measures of market income are typically not, and of disposable and gross income are typically not nearly so distinct. Instead, what one has, the Czechoslovak and Czech Republic cases, are compressed measures of household income, relatively low Gini coefficients for both gross and net income and market income where it's actually being measured. And even for that matter, for consumption measures, is the case of Hungary, Poland, Russia, where you have an enormously chaotic, massive increase in inequality in the early transition phase. But again, very little distinction between pre-market or pre-tax and post-tax inequality, because the tax systems were not designed to be redistributive. Rather, the pay structures were designed to be compressed in the first place. And you can see the same for the Ukraine. But once again, I would signal that even though our model is a very simple one with just two coefficients, it's not doing a bad job of mimicking the performance of survey data for gross income inequality where such data exist. And the advantage of it is that we can extend the information set over a substantially wider range and substantially more continuous series than is available from the survey record. One goes to developing countries. Underlying numbers tend to be a lot higher. The distinction between market gross and net tends to be a lot vaguer. But by and large, our model, once again, comes into the general range for gross income measures where they exist, with a few exceptions. Brazil is an exception, and South Africa is an exception. I'm not sure it will come up on these charts, but we'll see in a second. In the case of India, where the available survey-based measures have been of consumption, that's the yellow lines, they have been 20 Gini points lower than one would expect for an income-based measure. And our estimate of income inequality for India actually comes within just a point or two of the one available high-quality measure, which is by the Luxembourg Income Studies for around 2004 or so. Mexico, we're a little bit below. If you look at the overall averages in our series, once again, you get a pattern of shifting trends with very distinct turning points, of which the first important one is around 1971, second important one is around 1980, and allowing for the fact that the measure is distorted by adding in post-Soviet countries in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the third point is a peak around 2000. And I would suggest that that reflects a fairly strong reason to believe there exists in the world economy large forces that have been affecting masses of countries in similar ways and at the same time. And that is not, given those turning points, it's not hard to identify what those forces were likely to have been. 1971 was the dissolution of the Bretton Woods stabilization system, which provided a stabilizing framework for policy autonomy by the member states of the IMF. 1980, there followed in the 1970s a commodities and debt-fueled boom, which produced lower inequality in a great many countries of the developing world by our measures. That was reversed dramatically in 1980, and a 20-year period of rising inequality ensued, which began with the countries hit hardest by the debt crisis, Latin America, Africa. In the early 1980s, again, continued through Central and Eastern Europe into the early 1990s and culminated with the Asian crises in the late 1990s. There was a peak in 2000, a peak of the information technology boom in the United States, but also of inequality in much of the world. Interest rates fell, commodity prices recovered. China provided a export base for social democratic developments in much of Latin America and elsewhere. There was a retreat from neoliberal philosophy in many parts of the world, and including in Russia, and the inequality measures stabilized and declined slightly from 2000 forward. Given what is now happening to exchange rates in the same part of the world, we can fairly confidently predict that we're at another turning point and things will get worse from this point forward. So the hypothesis of a macroeconomic and financial role, a very strong one, in the movement of inequality has clear implications which can read from developments in the currency markets as they happen. I'll summarize my talk just by giving you a different set of maps that show you the levels of inequality and their evolution. This is decade by decade, using decadal averages to help fill in blank spots on the map, with a color scheme that runs from dark blue for the lowest measures of inequality in the low 20s or low to mid 20s through yellow, orange, and red for the higher measures. And you can see very clearly, this is the 1960s, that there existed a world in which the Western countries, the Western industrial countries, and of course this part of the world, Australia, New Zealand, were the epicenters of a relatively egalitarian societies, while the tropical and developing countries, in part and largely because of their industrial structure, which lacked the manufacturing basis of a modern middle class, were the high inequality regions of the world. And you can see how this develops over time as through the 1980s and the 1990s and into the 2000s, we have moved to a world which in a great many countries appear by these measures to resemble the inequality characteristically formally only of the developing world. Now, some of that is because of centers of great wealth developing that were not there before, centers of great private wealth, centers of great financial wealth. It is not to say that the structures of poverty of the previous period have been reproduced, but the structures of inequality appear to bear a stronger resemblance to what existed in the poor countries in the 1960s than they do to what existed in the rich countries in the 60s and 70s. With the same kind of data, and I'll just say this as a bit of an afterthought, one can do a great deal of interesting work on the political economy of individual countries and regions. One is not tied to the particular United Nations UNIDO-based data that I've been describing up till now. Simple sources like the Statistical Yearbook for China can reveal for us the evolution of inequality across both regions and sectors in China, with a very interesting result that shows that interregional inequality in China peaked as long ago as the early 2000s. And that was because the growth of the Chinese provinces became increasingly deconcentrated. It had previously been Guangdong, Shanghai, and Beijing taking the lion's share of development. Now a whole raft of second-tier provinces have emerged, if you like, and that has reduced the inter-provincial inequality measures. Whereas the sectoral inequalities in China continued to rise until the crisis in 2008, which delivered a marked check to that aspect of Chinese inequality. So while the literature continues to discuss the enormous rise in inequality in China, there is emerging evidence that that rise peaked overall around 2008, and some declines have occurred since then. If you look at Europe, you can take data from Eurostat, from its regional statistical database, for example, aggregated up by sector. It's a very flexible method. And what that does, if you use six sectors, is to show how the flow of incomes into finance drove the evolution of inequality for Europe as a whole, with a substantial decline after the financial crisis in 2008. So this is a phenomenon which emerges at the level of the European economy as a whole, and is accessible to us only because we're able to aggregate up across country lines, something which you cannot do with survey data unless you have the underlying micro data sets, which of course the Luxembourg studies do, but it is extremely laborious work and one which proceeds by just a few countries and observations at a time, whereas this is stuff that you can do for no money, essentially wholesale. And if you do it across regions in Europe, you can see very clearly the extraordinary importance of the income flows in just two places, London and Paris, in the overall evolution of inequality across regions in Europe, which is clearly a phenomenon of the financial sector in the city of London, and to a degree also in Paris, and a phenomenon which will be extremely interesting to monitor in the wake of what happened last week. One expects the statistical consequences that one observes at the continental level are not necessarily always those which you will find to be the most intuitive. But what I hope to have persuaded you in the course of this walk through a mass of empirical evidence is that there are patterns here which are strongly suggestive that if you want to explore basis for measured inequalities in our time, finance is a very good place to begin that exploration, and that this is fundamentally a monetary and a macroeconomic topic, and so that one is really in the business here of reintegrating the monetary macro insights of John Maynard Keynes and his successors into the broader structure of the society in which we live. And that strikes me as I said at the beginning, there are moments in which economics becomes interesting, and this is a very interesting challenge for us all. Thanks very much indeed.